Hello, my name is Amy Lane. I'm an occupational therapist and a certified driver rehabilitation specialist. I manage the Adaptive Driving Program, which is a driver rehabilitation program at the University of Pittsburgh. So today, we're going to be talking about driver rehabilitation and a couple things that I'd like to what we're going to do today, the intent of this session is to provide a general overview of driver rehabilitation. Briefly, we're going to review the impact of driving and the implication on one's independence in our society. We're going to talk about the different types of driver rehabilitation programs, review some common clinical diagnoses, and the functional impairments that impact driver capability. And then the fun part is to look at some of the adaptive driving equipment and vehicle modifications that are available and currently on the market. Okay. So those who are involved in healthcare probably realize this more so than others, the importance of driving and the independence that it represents for our patients, and how that affects quality of life. Driving is a cornerstone for independence in our society. And simply put, it's an inconvenience if you can't or you're unable to drive. So while it's certainly possible to engage in your daily activities, there are certainly some compromises and a level of inconvenience, especially for those who are not used to not driving. And with the advancement of transportation options, such as most recently our Uber self-driving cars, there are more opportunities more than ever today to get out and about. However, for most of the population, driving is still likely the most relied upon form of transportation in the U.S. So if you think about your own personal needs and your own work and social activities, how would you feel if you were not able to drive? Either permanently or temporarily or permanently. You know, how would you do your after-school activities for your kids? How would you go to the grocery store? And most importantly, how would you feel? And quite honestly, most of us would be very frustrated, upset. And multiple studies have actually shown that when older adults are told they can no longer drive, they were found to have increased complaints of hopelessness, social isolation, clinical depression, and progressive loss of function. And other longitudinal studies have shown a strong association between driving cessation and reduced physical functioning. So taking away one's driving privileges is not taken lightly. So just to give you another example of how meaningful driving is, in a little study done by Ann Dickerson at East Carolina University, she did a short study, a mixed design study using objective scales and some open-ended questions, interviewing older adults and their caregivers in an outpatient and day rehab setting, and basically asked, I think it was 60 participants, what instrumental activities of daily living were most important or most meaningful to them. And you can see the list of options here were shopping, planning a meal, cooking, driving was included there. And they were asked to basically rate these of which ones were the most important. And what we found is the most meaningful and important to the older adults was driving. And this was soon followed by medication management and phone use. So again, this just reemphasizes how important driving is for many of our clients, or return to driving is. So what is driver rehabilitation? And it is basically a specialized type of rehab that helps individuals with a disability or those who are affected with age-related changes achieve safe, independent driving or transportation options. It typically consists of an evaluation, training on specific skills, remediation, and or vehicle modification recommendations. And the ultimate goal is achieving a level of independence with community mobility, either as a driver or as a passenger. Now, to give you a brief history in the U.S., many driver rehab programs began in the early 70s through the Department of Veterans Affairs. So shout out to our VA programs. Since then, in 1977, the Association for Driver Rehab Specialists, also known as ADED, was founded to support and advance the profession. And today, ADED is the primary professional organization in driver rehabilitation. And the organization's membership continues to grow with a mission to promote excellence in this field. The National Mobility Equipment Dealers Association was founded in 1989, and they were a group of vehicle modifiers and also equipment manufacturers who kind of came together, and these are the folks that work with people who want to return to driving or be transported in vehicles modified with adaptive equipment. And then in 2003, the American Occupational Therapy Association developed an older driver initiative to help occupational therapists develop services for the older driver population. So the websites for many of these, specifically ADED and AOTA, also provide search options for those people who are looking for driver rehab programs or driver rehab specialists. So who's really involved and who are the key players in determining someone's fitness to drive? The decision-making process really works best when there is a collaborative effort. Rehab personnel are often tasked with making a determination on one's competence to drive after a hospitalization or if there's an obvious impairment. And that's really a huge burden to take on that responsibility alone. Ideally, we want to have a team working together, or at least know who our resources are. So an integrated healthcare team might consist of the physicians, and that can include your specialists such as neurologists, ophthalmologists, or even gerontologists. Your healthcare professionals, which are your therapists, nursing staff, family members are very important, and then also the driver rehabilitation specialist. But also, you want to consider that we have the Department of Motor Vehicles or your licensing authority may need to be involved. We may have funding sources that will often be directing when and how to obtain services, the mobility equipment dealer or the vehicle and manufacturing equipment representative may be involved. So all of these people really have the knowledge and the skills that help to make decisions about the person's ability to resume driving with or without modifications. So it's not just the driver rehab specialist or the certified driver rehab specialist, but that is definitely a key player. And so let's take a minute to talk about that role. So the driver rehab specialist is the person who plans, develops, and coordinates and implements driver rehab services. And typically, those are people who have a healthcare background, like OT, PT, or speech. Or it could be somebody who has a traffic safety or traffic education background. And these are the specialists or professionals who work in the field of driver rehab, driver training, transportation, equipment modifications for persons of all ages and abilities, or those who have age-related changes. The certified driver rehabilitation specialist is somebody who's gone above and beyond to gain additional training, education, and has additional years of experience. And the specialty certification is offered by the Association for Driver Rehab Specialists through an examination. And the certification really validates the education and experiences, basically saying that this CDRS is an expert in the field. ADED's best practices really does support the CDRS evaluation and rehab process, and it's considered the standard in the practice or standards for practice in this field. So, One last thing about the CDRS, though, is there is extremely a high demand for more individuals to become practicing certified driver rehab specialists. So there's definitely a need for it in the U.S. as well as internationally. So now, how do we assess driver capability? And there's a variety of methods to do so, and this is just a list of a couple ways that we might determine somebody's ability to drive. The AMA Physician's Guide to Assessing and Counseling Older Drivers is a free resource available through the AMA or through the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. And it basically gives a nice summary of things that you would might need to assess or physicians would need to assess to determine if somebody is fit to drive, including referral to different programs and driver rehab specialists. There's also driving simulators, and so they certainly have a place in assessing somebody's fitness to drive. There are some drawbacks with driving simulators, and this can include things like motion sickness, simulator sickness, and we have a lot of older adults who sometimes, not often, but sometimes have difficulty with the simulators. Family and caregiver report can often be a very good method in giving feedback about somebody's ability to drive, whereas self-assessment is not always the best method because, let's face it, everybody thinks they're a good driver. And so when you have cognitive decline or other medical impairments affecting your abilities, sometimes self-reflection and self-assessment is a little skewed. So not always the best method to assess your ability to drive or not. We also have our State Licensing Bureau, or Department of Motor Vehicles, and that is our licensing authority. So they most certainly are the ones that first administer a driver's license, and so we have to respect that they are definitely one method of assessing ability to drive. And then the last thing I have listed here is driver rehab programs. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that because there really are a variety of driver rehab programs available, and you'll see that in the next slide. So, now what you're looking at here is a document that was an outcome of a special project between the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, AOTA, and ADED. And in looking at this document, you can recognize that, you know, there are a lot of different types of programs out there. And really, when we're talking about driving services, it's a multidisciplinary field with a diversity of programs available for the consumer. But the purpose of this document was really to help differentiate different programs based on their levels of service, also the type of provider, as well as the provider's knowledge. And the idea is to help avoid confusion when, you know, a physician may refer somebody to a driving program and the person may think that a web-based self-screening tool is the same as a comprehensive driving program. And they're not. They're distinctively different. So this document helps to identify those differences and hopefully helps the consumer as well as the stakeholders involved in driving services understand the differences of the program. So if we look at this red box, specifically the section on medically based assessment, education, and referral, you could see that the typical providers here are usually healthcare professionals or OTs, sometimes driver rehabilitation specialists. And this clearly defines that provider specialty area and gives you a sense these are the people that can do the clinical screenings or the clinical evaluations, also known as, sometimes we use the term pre-driver's evaluation. So this is a clinically based assessment of driving skills. So it's not the on-road part, it's just the clinical based assessment. To the right of that red box, you'll see where it goes into the driver rehab program. So we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But again, this hopefully helps people understand the differences of programs and what services they're getting. On the second page of this document, the driver rehab programs are definitely more clearly delineated. and you'll see the difference of basic versus low-tech versus high-tech. And I know it's hard to see on this slide, but this is definitely worthwhile to print out, look at this more carefully at the content, so that you can clearly understand the differences of a basic program where they might not be providing any equipment options, low-tech, maybe strictly mechanically based equipment, and where high-tech, not only are you doing everything in the basic and low-tech programs, but you're also looking at electronic systems and definitely higher-tech driving systems. So hopefully that gives you a sense of the different types of programs. But what exactly does a driver rehab program do? And a comprehensive program will typically follow this process. There's a referral, there's an intake on information about their driving medical history. As I mentioned before, there's a clinical, then an on-road assessment, training when indicated, vehicle equipment assessment when indicated, and then we provide recommendations. This is based on the ADED's best practice guidelines, which were developed to ensure that the delivery of professional and comprehensive services were done in this manner. It's not just because you're a member of ADED or you're a certified driver rehab specialist, but the intent is that everybody who's providing driver rehab services should follow this typical process because this is the best practice and standards. So let's go in a little bit more detail about what's involved. So the first thing we want to look at is demographics. So some information that you might have before a person even arrives. So I'm looking at things like, do they have a driver's license? Who's the referral source? Who is the referring physician? Next, we want to get some information about their medical history. And it's really important to get a good medical history. Is it a medically stable condition, or is it a progressive condition? And are there secondary complications? So we really want to get a good picture of what the person's any medical disability, the impairments. We really want to get a sense of what those are because that's going to help us set a stage for what we need to look at when we get in the clinical and the behind-the-wheel assessments. Next, we want to get an idea of what the medications the person is taking. And sometimes even looking at medications, that helps me know that the person has another medical condition. They may list that they're taking a cardiovascular medication, which they initially denied, or they're on high doses of narcotics. And, you know, that really does help me identify and lead me to other questions about their history. Next, I definitely need to know if there's any seizure history. Most states in the U.S. have restrictions for seizure history. It's usually 6 to 12 months that the person needs to be seizure-free before they can resume driving. So that is always a standard question on our interview. And then also I want to get a sense, is there any history of substance use and abuse? And this is things related to alcohol, prescription or over-the-counter medication, controlled substances, and as I mentioned before, if they're using any types of narcotics or even illegal drugs. I want to get an idea of what those are. The other things we're looking for in the clinical interview is things about their living situation and their support system. If they're dependent on family members for completing things like their basic self-cares or their independent living skills, you know, are they really ready to pursue independence with driving if they can't do their basic independent living skills? And a great example of that is I recently had a young client who she had spina bifida and as well as some attention and focus issues, and she was very interested in trying to drive, namely because her peers were beginning to drive. So she was young. She was about 17 years old. But when I talked to her about some of her living situation and her functional skills, I asked if she was doing anything around the house to help out, and her parents would not allow her to do anything in the kitchen, prepare a meal, because they were worried about her safety in the kitchen. So they didn't want her using the stove or carrying anything hot because they were worried she was going to spill or she might forget to turn off the stove, and which you know, I completely understand. Now, when I asked about other chores around the house, she wasn't doing anything because of her physical impairments. So that was understandable. But then I asked questions about community mobility, and she was not allowed to go out in the community by herself because her mother was afraid she wouldn't always check properly for traffic before crossing the street. So she was not able to go, for example, to the mall and the parking lot and walk across the parking lot into the mall by herself because her mother was afraid, you know, she may miss a car when she was walking across the street. So my take on this is that if you're not safe enough to use a stove because you're worried somebody's not going to be remembering to turn off the stove, or you can't cross the street because you're worried they're not going to pay attention to cars coming, it may not be time to drive yet because you're not demonstrating some of those core skills, those core independent living skills that you need to have before we put you behind the wheel of a car. So overall, again, the clinical interview, we really just want to get a good idea of their basic functional skills and what they're able to do and what they're not able to do. So next in this process is the clinical assessment. This looks at the components required for driving. So it's important to note that this is not necessarily predictive of driving ability, but it can certainly help to explain driving performance errors. It usually takes about 45 minutes to 60 minutes to complete this assessment, and it starts first with a clinical screen, or the vision screen, visual perceptual assessment. And visual perceptual assessment is just really detecting, are there any visual or perceptual deficits. As far as the cognitive screen, we really want to look at all types of cognitive functioning, and that can include things like attention, a person's ability to follow directions, do they have an awareness of what their abilities are or their deficit areas are, how quickly can they shift their attention or divided attention skills. Information processing and the reaction time is critical for driving, so we want to make get a good sense of what their information processing time is, as well as looking at things like their short-term memory. Communication and behavior obviously is very important. They have to be able to communicate and also understand written language and read road signs. We want to know what their knowledge of driving is, and also their motor mobility skills. So I want to make sure they've got sufficient range of motion, strength, coordination, as well as sensation. And then also we want to look at their wheelchair or mobility skills. So while clinical assessments are very important and help us determine clients' functional skills and the deficit areas, the on-road assessment is crucial to understanding the impact of these identified impairments on the client's actual driving performance and their driving potential. So for most clients, we're looking to see if they can operate a vehicle, or maybe they're able to use adaptive equipment to operate a car. But the evaluation should also allow an assessment of their ability to transfer in and out of the vehicle. Also, can they walk up to the vehicle, and do they have the balance and the endurance to do something like that? Can they stow and secure their mobility device? Also, we kind of look at, is this actually the best vehicle for them? Because maybe they can't drive their sports car anymore because now they're using a power wheelchair and it's just not going to be a good match. So they may need to be exploring different vehicles. The on-road assessment typically lasts one, sometimes up to 2 hours. We usually, a little over an hour is about how long it takes. After that, most people tend to get a little tired and fatigued. But we want to assess the client's driving performance in a progressively complex traffic situation. So we're going to start slow in a parking lot, low traffic, and then progress up into moderate, high traffic, where the client is now dealing with city, highway, interstate, maximum stimuli. That said, the driving route may be changed depending on the client's clinical diagnosis. My set routes that I might take somebody on might change depending on changes or concerns that I've identified during the clinical assessment. If the client is using new equipment, I will then stick predominantly with a training area. We may not get outside of a parking lot or a neighborhood area if it's the first time they're driving with specialized equipment. But of course, if it's an experienced driver, we're going to be assessing all types of traffic situations. So remember, the purpose of this assessment is really to determine the baseline function for driving. So any problems or errors that we've detected during the evaluation are going to have to be addressed. So there's going to be differences in a new driver versus an experienced driver, whether or not they're using adaptive equipment. But at the end of the road test, I really have to formulate a plan for what's going to happen next. You know, are they going to need adaptive driving equipment? Are they going to need training? Do I need to refer them to a different service, a different program, or do they need additional therapies before we pursue driving? And the role of the specialist really is there to help make some of these very difficult decisions. At the end of the evaluation, simply put, I want to know one of three things. Can they continue to be licensed? Do they need additional training? Or are we going to recommend driving cessation? But that said, there's a variety of recommendations and alternatives that can occur from this evaluation. For example, maybe they're not ready to drive just yet. You know, we're doing the evaluation too soon after their injury and they need a reevaluation. Maybe they should come back in a couple months. Or maybe there's additional restrictions or recommendations that have been given to the person based on their current function and their driving performance. And then sometimes even a state driving examination or a reevaluation is recommended. So remember, the state is the state's driving license authority is really the determination of somebody's ability to drive. They are our overarching licensing authority. That said, they often rely on the input of doctors, driver rehab specialists, or other healthcare professionals to help make that decision. One of the things I have to do frequently is advise and assist my clients in what are the regulatory requirements, what are the license requirements to drive in our state. With specialized equipment, they need to go through state testing, and they actually have to have their driver's license coded to reflect the use of that adaptive equipment. So part of my role is making sure that my clients understand this process and how to work with the state transportation bureau. That's it. With that in mind, it is also important that the healthcare practitioner, regardless if you're a specialist or not, know what the state's medical restrictions are, or at least what the basics are. In most states, there are physical and mental criteria that we have to abide by. In the state of Pennsylvania, it is very clear from our Department of Transportation's medical unit who can and cannot drive based on these criteria. Most states have vision standards, and for most states, it's usually around 20/40 or better visual acuity. That's with correction. Most states have peripheral vision restrictions. Again, in the state of Pennsylvania, you have to have at least 120 degrees of peripheral vision. And also, there are often seizure restrictions. As I mentioned before, frequently it's between 6 months and 12 months seizure-free with or without medications. So, it is very evident, hopefully, that driving is one of the most demanding tasks that we do. And it's something that, you know, we kind of take for granted when we get up out of bed in the morning, we jump in the car and go to school or go to work. We kind of take that for granted. But changes in health due to injuries, medical conditions, visual changes, physical changes are going to affect a person's ability to drive. Driver rehab specialists work with a multitude of different types of clinical populations and diagnoses. And with that in mind, there are a variety of things to consider when assessing fitness to drive. So today, in this brief overview of driving, I wanted to address a few of the clinical conditions that we might work with in driver rehab and discuss how a person with a specific diagnosis might present clinically, and then give some examples of how that might affect their driving ability. So to start with, one of the more popular subjects these days are concerns about the older driver. So what is the big concern? Obviously, baby boomers are now turning 65, and between now and 2050, the trend is on and moving quite quickly upward. So there is going to be more and more older drivers out on the road. Let's look at some of the statistics. From 2003 to 2013, there was a 22% increase in drivers over the age of 50. And in 2011, 16% of all licensed drivers were over the age of 65. That's pretty significant. But with that trend, they are anticipating by the year 2050, one in every four drivers will be somebody over the age of 65. And so imagine that today as you're driving home, as you look around you, imagine one out of every four people around you is going to be over the age of 65. And that is pretty startling statistics. And I don't say that to scare anybody because, you know, hopefully we're all going to be in that age category soon or be one of those people. But it is something to consider as we have that squaring off of our older population. So let's talk about a couple other things about older drivers, some good and some bad. As older drivers plan for their retirement, or older adults, I should say, plan for their retirement, they think about things like finances, where they're going to live, are they going to sell their home, who's going to manage their money. They're talking about advanced directives, but they're not always talking about what are they going to do when they can't drive. And statistics show that most people do need to stop driving before end of life. And we don't often talk to our older adults about stopping driving, as we should. And so why is that so difficult? And part of it comes down to where people live. If you consider that those people who live outside urban areas, where they're living, they don't often have busing options. They don't have access to mass transportation or taxi cabs. So the further you live from an urban area, the number of transportation options typically decrease. And so driving, or driving your own vehicle, would be the only way for seniors to get out and about, run errands, go grocery shopping. And so they don't want to give it up. Some other factors to think about with our older adults is that older drivers, especially those over the age of 65, even though the numbers of accidents are about the same as younger drivers, as that 16 to 18 age group, the number of fatalities and accidents are about the same, but the difference is that the older drivers are driving less miles than the young ones. The other thing is those older drivers are most often to sustain more severe injuries leading to end of life, whereas the younger drivers may recover from their injuries. On a positive note, most older drivers are not very aggressive. They don't typically speed. They don't typically drive in bad weather. They limit their driving at night. I think about a client that I had. He was 80-something, and he was telling me that in lieu of their 65-year class reunion, his class has opted to do quarterly lunches during the daytime because they don't want to drive at night anymore. They don't want to be out during rush hour. They don't want to have to drive at night because driving at night, quite honestly, is more difficult for them. And so they've changed when they're going out and about. They're regulating that to meet their own needs. And so you have to give them kudos for that, that they've made some good decisions on how and when they want to drive. Most older drivers are very few, are not risk takers. So you don't typically see them talking on their cell phones while they're driving, and rarely, if ever, do you see them attempting to text while they're driving. So you don't typically see that with our older adults. The exception with our older adults, though, is some has to do with alcohol. Some studies have actually shown that older adults don't always recognize those dangers, and some of that may be due to a past history of when it was more acceptable to and less restrictive with drinking and driving. So the other major concern we have with older drivers is that they don't always know when to give up their driver's license. When asked, they'll say they know, and they'll recognize it, but they continue to dismiss, or they don't always recognize those warning signs. So some of those warning signs are those age-related changes, like vision. Things like cataracts, glaucoma, or macular degeneration are more common with older adults and often underdiagnosed. Chronic medical conditions like diabetes can affect multiple aspects of a person's function. It could affect their vision, cognition. Things like peripheral neuropathy can occur. And the dilemma we have is these are not things that occur immediately. They creep up over time, and so the older driver doesn't always recognize that these are actually starting to impact their driving ability. Progressive diseases, such as dementia or Parkinson's. Adults with these conditions can often drive relatively well and safely when they're newly diagnosed, but the disease, as it progresses, they may have complications that are going to eventually affect their ability to operate a vehicle. And, of course, medications can have multiple side effects that can affect driving. And there are concerns with drug interactions with prescribed medications when taken with over-the-counter medications. And additionally, sometimes we'll have clients that forget to take their medications, and that could be huge, especially when we're dealing with issues like blood sugar regulation or cardiovascular regulatory medications. Okay, so deciding if and when it's time to stop driving is really difficult and emotional. And remember, it's not the age. Sometimes it's the medical condition that's affecting the person's ability to drive. So they can sometimes continue to drive for a period of time because they've got really good habits and experiences. They're well ingrained habits, and so they're able to continue to drive relatively well. But at some point, the medical conditions, for example, cognitive decline, are going to start showing up in that person's ability to drive. So some of the signs we might see are things like this, where they're driving too slowly and, you know, they don't observe the signs. They may have problems interpreting traffic situations or predicting changes in what's coming up. Common error that we'll see with our older adults is they don't always yield. They may not even recognize that the other driver has the right of way and fails to see that. Sometimes they get easily frustrated or confused. Maybe they're driving too slowly, somebody beeps their horn at them, they get a little flustered, they get frustrated, and sometimes they can get lost. Often we have people who have cognitive decline start to rely on their passengers for co-piloting. So somebody is actually giving them instructions on road signs, lane markings, oh, watch out for that car, you know, be careful, okay, or even monitoring before they do a lane change from the left lane to the right chain, or left lane to the right lane. The co-pilot is actually doing the checking for them to make sure that it's clear before they move and change lanes. And something I see a lot with my older driver evaluations is if I get the opportunity to take a look at their vehicle, I'll find that there's lots of scratches and dents on their vehicle. They don't even recognize that. And they don't even realize how many they have or how that occurred. So the following here are some problems that the older driver may experience and likely are due to changes in visual skills. So due to a variety of reasons, you know, the older driver may not always recognize that there's been a significant change in their vision function. And as a result of the visual decline, they may not be able to read the road signs. They may not even be able to read their dashboard indicators due to a loss of contrast sensitivity, and that's the ability of the eyes to detect various shades of gray or color shades against the background. So due to that loss of contrast sensitivity, that can affect their visual acuity, and they may not even be able to see on a gray overcast day where maybe there's a little bit of rain and an oncoming car that's a shade of gray or a darker car that doesn't have the headlights on. Somebody who has problems with contrast sensitivity may not even see that vehicle until it's upon them. So under optimal lighting conditions, they have good visual acuity when tested, but that visual acuity is greatly reduced once they're in those poor lighting conditions. Some of these older adults also have problems with glare recovery. So an example of that is when traveling through a tunnel. These are the people that it's bright, sunny outside, and as soon as they enter that tunnel and it's dark, they slam on their brakes because they cannot see for sometimes 5 to 10 seconds until their eyes adjust to that change in light. Some other problems we might see is poor estimation of space and time when making a turn. And that can show up especially when there's an intersection where it's a left turn and the intersection is not controlled by a traffic light, so there's no arrow signal, and the older driver may have a hard time estimating that available space between where they are and the oncoming vehicle. We'll also see some problems with the client who cannot maintain a central lane position. They're going to cross, or they'll drive over the right side or the left side of the lane. Or more seriously, they start side-swiping cars, taking off side-view mirrors in city driving, or jumping curbs or bumping into barriers. So again, these are some of the common driving-related issues we might see with the older adults. So in talking about neurological conditions, obviously there are numerous disorders, both congenital or acquired. And some common conditions that we see in driver rehab are brain injury, stroke, MS, or spinal cord injury. And the potential residual effects of these on a person's vision, sensation, motor, or cognitive functioning could be minimal or it could be quite extensive. And then, of course, it's going to affect their driving ability. So what I thought I would do is just address a few of these today. And we're going to start with brain injury. First, we need to recognize that the ability to resume employment or social activities or leisure activities, personal relationships, is so very, very important to this population. And the loss of the role, those meaningful roles that they have, can have a negative impact on their emotional state. So when they're restricted in their driving and they're not able to engage in those activities, you can imagine how important it is for this specific population. Now, depending on the severity and the location of the brain injury, the residual effects can be, you know, visual, physical, cognitive. It's multifaceted. The typical behavioral changes that we might see can include things like anger control issues, restlessness, agitation. They may not obey all the rules. They may have been risk takers before their injury, and now they have another brain injury on top of an already risk-taking type behavior. What's really interesting is that second bullet point here, that nearly half of this population will resume driving, 66% without any formal evaluation. So that's a little scary in my eyes to think about, that these people are not getting properly evaluated, considering the multitude and the complex type of residual effects of their injury. So despite the importance of driving and the return to driving plays in community reintegration, these people who have sustained a brain injury really need to be reassessed, and we need to make sure that we are including them in that rehab continuum and making sure that they're properly assessed, and you're addressing this in rehab. So, some of the issues that we might see in the evaluation or training as they attempt to return to driving are that they have sometimes the endurance and the sustained attention and focus to hold it together to do relatively well for 20, 30 minutes of the evaluation, but that on-road eval really needs to provide them with as many situations and scenarios as possible. And that actually provides a little bit better of a challenge to those who have higher level cognitive and executive issues. What I typically do is I'll start in a protected area, especially if there are concerns about impulsivity or other behavioral issues that I might have picked up during the clinical evaluation. I also have to think about carefully wording my directions, because I don't want to say, okay, turn right here, turn right, or turn right at the next light, because they literally will start to turn right before we're even at the traffic light. So I have to be very careful about how I'm presenting my wording in the assessment. So I may say things like, at the next traffic light, make a right-hand turn, so that they are able to process that information. I'll also look at topographical orientation. I want to know, can they find their way? During the evaluation process, I'll give them directions on where to turn, where we're going, turn right here, turn left here. But often, during the evaluation, I'll switch it to more of a self-directed method of evaluation. So I may give them a specific location to travel to and see if they can navigate it. The other thing I'd like to do with this population is really observe their responses when other drivers make mistakes. So I want to know, are they going to become overly aggressive? Are they being impulsive as well? And sometimes I had a lot of my clients with this diagnosis, we see signs of road rage. They just get very, very upset with other drivers and attempt to punish the other driver when another driver makes a mistake. And then some of the other things I want to look at is their level of endurance and fatigue. Their attention and focus can be good for a little bit, but as they fatigue over time, up 45 minutes to an hour, often what we'll find is that they can then start to decline in their function, and their driving skills actually start to decline. Sometimes with this population, I'll actually schedule two different on-road sessions to make sure that I'm able to assess consistent, good driving behaviors. So, a few comments about clients who have had strokes. Just like my clients with traumatic brain injury, the clinical presentation can be varied depending on the area of the brain that was affected by the stroke. And depending on the state regulations, visual impairments like visual field loss may be a contraindication for driving. Visual neglect, which is unlike visual field loss, because that visual neglect is more like a sensory loss where the client is demonstrating a generalized inattention to that visual field or visual area. Visual neglect is almost always a contraindication for driving. Some of the other concerns related to driving might include, what is the functional use of the extremity? Does the person have any balance or mobility issues? What is their generalized cognitive skills? And then, are their communication skills affected by the stroke? And let's talk about that real quickly. In terms of communication deficits, often we'll have clients who present with aphasia or the ability to understand or speak. So that could be receptive or expressive aphasia. And aphasia can be particularly an issue when we're having somebody who needs to read maps or follow directions or read road signs. So in the case here, in, as you see on the slide, somebody with aphasia may very easily recognize a stop sign. You know, it's by the color, the shape, it's the only sign that's like this. However, can they read those additional words that are around it, which are very relevant for that traffic situation? So the image on the left says stop, accept right turn. Can they read that, interpret that, and follow through with that? And I always like to include that in my evaluation with this population. Likewise, the picture on the right, there's lots of information given to the driver there. Yes, you have to stop, but cross traffic doesn't stop. It's a one-way road. Bikes don't have to stop. Bikes don't have to go one way. So there's a lot of information there that we need to know. Can that person with aphasia read that, understand it, and be successful in negotiating that situation? Persons who have sustained a stroke often experience hemiparesis and may be in need of adaptive equipment. So in cases of somebody who has a right hemiparesis, they're no longer able to use their right foot on the gas and brake. And what you see here is an example of a mechanical left foot accelerator, and that's the image on the left. So there's a pedal guard that's placed in front of the original gas pedal. A roller is on top of that original gas pedal. It comes over and up over to the left-hand side, and now they have a gas pedal located on the left-hand side of the brake. So now they gas and brake with their left foot. Alternative to that, on the right side of the slide, is an image of an electronic version of a left-foot gas pedal. It's a little different. It looks a little nicer, kind of a slicker device. It's a little bit more expensive, actually probably 3 to 4 times more expensive. The nice thing about this, though, is that it has an electronic or a switch that actually activates the left gas pedal. And so the intent of that is to help decrease the occurrence of hitting the wrong pedal when driving. Some other equipment that a person with a stroke might use is a parking brake extension, and that's the picture on the left. So somebody who can no longer use their left side, their left foot or left to depress that pedal, maybe they could reach over and depress that pedal. More often, newer cars are coming out with electronic parking brakes, and that's the image on the right, where the person just pulls their finger and that engages the parking brake, and again, with the push of the finger, it releases that. Those parking brake, electronic parking brakes, have been available for aftermarket installation for years, so it's interesting to see now that more and more cars, newer cars, are having that as an option in their vehicles. Some of the other devices you might see are steering devices, and the top two images are examples of spinner knobs. The top right shows a spinner knob with a turn signal crossover. So a person who might have had a stroke and doesn't have use of their left hand to access the turn signal can now reach up with their right hand and access the turn signal and use the spinner knob to steer the vehicle. The bottom three images are other types of steering devices. The bottom middle image is really a quite interesting device in that it's not only a steering device, it kind of looks like a gaming device. It's a very nice and comfortable handhold. But what you can do is program with the switches all your secondary controls. So that way a person who has had a stroke and is driving with and steering with just their right hand can then use their thumb to access all their secondary controls, things like your turn signals, your windshield wipers, horn, or headlights. So there's a variety of different devices on the market. And the idea is that the driver rehab specialist will be able to show the person who needs these devices and make sure they're giving them the right equipment with the right amount of training. So the next neurological condition I want to talk about is spinal cord injury. And again, this is the one population that I really like to stress that evaluation and training by a driver rehab specialist is very important. Because we want to consider all their functional skills, abilities, and most importantly, we're going to try out the adaptive equipment before prescribing or that the client purchases. There are a variety of considerations and issues with clients who have spinal cord injury, and these are some of the issues. We need to consider this related to driving. Autonomic dysreflexia, for example, is a very, very life-threatening condition. For those people who are at a spinal cord level of T5 or higher. And related to driving, we need to be conscientious of that when they're in the vehicle and if they're using a seatbelt or a chest support to hold them in place, we need to make sure it's not too tight, cutting off their circulation or causing them to have elevated blood pressure. Some of the other things we need to be aware of is, you know, skin integrity issues. We need to make sure that they're doing pressure relief when they're driving. Inability to regulate their body temperature can be a huge factor, making sure that the temperature in the vehicle is good for them. So. A spinal cord injury can vary depending on the severity of the level of injury or the severity of the injury, the segment of the injury on the spinal cord, and the extent of the damage. So that level of injury really equates to what their functional ability is. And obviously that level of injury helps me as a driver rehab specialist help predict what that person's function will be and helps me estimate what type of adaptive equipment or vehicle modifications they're going to need. Vehicle options for a person with a spinal cord injury can range from a simple sedan to something that's more extensive like a wheelchair-accessible vehicle. And the type of vehicle may be limited due to their functional abilities and skills. So, for example, somebody who has a spinal cord injury at the C6-7 level, they may be able to transfer from their manual wheelchair into a car seat. They may be able to break down their wheelchair and transfer it into the vehicle, whereas another person who is at a C6-7 spinal cord injury level may choose to ride in their power wheelchair and drive from their power wheelchair just because transfers are much more effortful for them. So again, the type of vehicle and equipment is not only the level of injury but also their functional skills. So what I'd like to do is go over a couple of the vehicle options and equipment options for clients with spinal cord injuries. So minivans are quite popular for many because it allows safe, quick access into the vehicle. There's really no need to transfer outside of the vehicle. And depending the make, model, and the conversion on the vehicle, we could have a variety of different specs, such as the ramp angle, the door opening, the door height. Think about clients who sit really tall in their wheelchairs. We want to make sure they have ample height in that door opening so that they're not hitting their head getting in and out of the vehicle. So there's a lot of different varieties of vehicles, and we need to consider all that when we're looking at our clients and what's the best fit for them. These days, there's more and more alternatives to the minivan. For example, there are now SUVs that are being modified with ramps. They're a little bit smaller in the inside, but for the right person with the right size chair, this can certainly be a perfect fit and a nice option for somebody who's driving or riding as a passenger. Another alternative are trucks, And, you know, some people just want to drive their trucks. And so there are options for them as well. This company in particular manufactures full-size GM trucks. They do the Cadillac, the Escalade, a Suburban, the Yukon. So they're modifying specific vehicles. And this modification is a pretty slick. What happens is the door pops open, a platform drops down, and as you can see on the image on the left, the person who is using a wheelchair is going to be driving from their wheelchair, so they don't have to do a transfer. What they would do is back their wheelchair up onto that platform, and then the platform raises, and then the platform and the door closes into the cab, and then the person rides from their wheelchair. So very nice device, and it gives, again, people another option other than just the wheelchair-accessible van. This is an example of a power seat base. So often we have clients who are using a chair in a wheelchair-accessible van who cannot transfer up into that front driver's position. So this is an example of a power seat base. It's a six-way direction, so it can go up, down, forward, back, as well as swivel. And a person who is using a wheelchair can then transfer, do a nice lateral scoot from the wheelchair into the driver's seat. There's also a passenger application for this. So you can, if the person wants to ride in the front passenger seat, they can do that as well. But it's a nice feature so that a person who maybe has a great difficulty transferring into that driver's seat has another option. The wheelchair itself, when it's sitting inside the van, needs to be secure in some manner. For many people, they want to be as independent as possible, and one option is to do some automatic docking system. This is one example of an automatic system. So that base plate is mounted on the floor. There is a pin that looks like a bolt that's attached to the underside of the wheelchair, and the person rides that bolt into that docking station. And again, there are certainly tie-down tracks in most wheelchair-accessible vans that you can use, but they're really not designed for the independent for independence. It's very difficult to do that and secure that properly. This automatic docking system is really designed more for the person to be more independent and to be able to do that securement system themselves. That way the wheelchair does not become a projectile in case there is an accident and the wheelchair does not go flying through the cab of the vehicle. Another option for wheelchair securement is the side-mounted docking system. For many, many years, the only way we had docking systems was on the underside of the wheelchair, and this is a new alternative, so it's side-mounted, and you can see what it looks like on the left. That's the docking system, and the image on the right actually shows the driver with the system engaged. So it doesn't take up a lot of space, and it's a really nice form. It's a nice size, and it eliminates any of that ground clearance issues that you might have with a securement system that's mounted on the underside of the wheelchair. This is another example of a method to transfer into a vehicle. In this case, it's a truck. And as you can see here, once the person is transferred from their wheelchair into a seat that deploys out of the cab of the car, with that boom arm, a cable deploys, it attaches to the power wheelchair, and with a handheld pendant, this driver is able to push a button, that cable retracts, lifting the wheelchair up and into the cab, and allows the person to be more independent and less reliant on somebody else to lift their wheelchair into the cab of the car. Can we take a break right now?
5-4-3.
Okay. So persons who, and the next slide, persons who have a loss of function of their hand controls, or loss of function in their lower extremities, may need to use hand controls to operate their vehicle. So examples of hand controls on the left, I believe that might be a push right angle, and the hand control on the right side of the image is a push-pull system. So mechanical hand controls allow the person who no longer has use of their legs the ability to operate the vehicle with their hands. So the left hand will operate the gas brake, the right hand will then steer the vehicle. Most mechanical hand controls pushing forward will always activate the brake, and then the second word in the description is the acceleration. So in a push-pull system, the pulling motion activates the gas pedal. And in this image here, you'll see two examples of steering devices with the hand controls. The image on the left is a tri-pin, and that's typically used for somebody who uses a tenodesis grip. So somebody at a spinal cord injury level at, say, C6, C7 or higher is going to use or may use a tenodesis grip. So that means as the wrist comes back, the fingers flex, and with that motion, they're able to use that tri-pin to actually hold on to the steering wheel and power through their turns. For those people who are unable to use mechanical hand controls or low-tech systems, there are a variety of high-tech systems available. And with spinal cord injury clients, we're looking at somebody who maybe is at a C5, C6 level with using something like this. And it's no longer a mechanical device. Now we're looking more at electronic devices. So on the left, you'll see an electronic gas brake. And again, the person is using a tri-pin for their hand. And then they're using more than likely a tri-pin in the steering wheel as well to steer the vehicle. So moving on, looking at orthopedic conditions, there are, again, numerous conditions that might impact a person's ability to operate a vehicle. And these are just a few of the examples. And I'm going to talk real briefly about just amputation and driving. So what we need to think about is, what is the reason for the amputation? Is it an accident, or was this due to a congenital or health-related complication like diabetes? And that's very important, because when we're prescribing the adaptive equipment, we want to make sure that it's equipment that's going to last. If somebody has complications related to diabetes and has lost one limb, we don't want to train them in using the left leg to drive if there's a chance, even a slim chance, that there may be the same complications in the left limb. So we may want to just look at hand controls for somebody who has lower extremity loss, amputation loss because of diabetes. So the other things we're going to look at is secondary issues. Are there any vision or sensory changes that are going to impact driving? What are the ambulation or transfer issues? So somebody who has a lower extremity amputation, is the prosthesis going to be in the way of their leg, the leg space in the cab of the car? Can they transfer in and out of the vehicle? You know, if they have a mobility device, are they able to get that into the vehicle, or how are they going to store that? For somebody who has an upper extremity amputation, we have to think about, what do you do with each extremity when operating a vehicle? You know, what exactly does your right hand do, and what exactly does your left hand do when you're driving? So you have to kind of think about that, and how are we going to accommodate for those functions? And a good example of that is, and the next slide, this is a client of mine who, due to an explosion, lost all of his fingers on his left hand, except for his forefinger and his thumb, and lost his right arm below the elbow. Using his left hand, he was able to use a steering device that has a variety of secondary functions attached to it. So with his forefinger and his thumb, he's able to depress the turn signal and the windshield wiper. And with his right hand, he has a myoelectric prosthesis, and it's sufficient enough that he can do things like extend his forefinger to depress, hazard button, or he can depress the air conditioning buttons, and he has enough grip in it that he can actually shift gears. So again, we have to consider what the right arm is doing and what the left arm is doing and how we're going to modify the vehicle for that. For someone who no longer has use of their right leg or even both legs, again, they're probably going to need mechanical hand controls. And again, these are two more examples of different types of hand controls installed in vehicles. When they're using hand controls, they're likely going to need to use some type of steering device to steer the vehicle as well. Arthritis and driving, we need to think about, what is the reason for the referral? Often arthritis is in itself is a secondary complication for many of our referrals, but sometimes it still needs to be addressed because the pain related to arthritis can be a significant factor and a variable in a person's ability to drive. And there's a lot of different modifications available for people who have arthritis. I always like to think in terms of, some of this equipment is available out on the market. You can certainly go on the web and search for information about equipment. But I always remind people that any equipment that's attached or affects primary controls, so things like gas brake steering or any possible modifications that the driver needs to quickly access, we call that rapid access secondary controls, so things like windshield wipers or turn signals. Anytime you're dealing with that type of equipment, that really should be prescribed and recommended through a driver rehab specialist, often because state testing is required for those people because it's affecting the control of the vehicle. But, again, there's a variety of modifications on the market for persons to purchase for that non-rapid access, which may help the person driving with their driving comfort. So some examples are a seat belt, grab handle, blind spot mirrors or convex mirrors. That's a great way for somebody who has arthritis and limited neck range of motion or mobility to see what's coming around them. Sometimes a driver needs to practice using these mirrors because they're quite different in how you're viewing what's going on behind you and around you, and sometimes it takes a little bit of time to get used to that. On the bottom left is a handy bar. That's a really nice device. It's very simple. It's installed. The person puts it in the striker plate in the door lock of their vehicle and allows the person to have a handle when they're standing up and sitting down, getting in and out of their vehicle. And then, of course, there's a variety of seat cushions and lumbar supports that can help the client become more comfortable in their seating position in their vehicle. Some other non-rapid access secondary controls that you might see are devices, people have a hard time sometimes depressing those buttons on their gear shifters or their emergency brakes. And so these are just different devices that we can attach to gear shifters or the emergency brake to, again, make it easier for the person who has limited dexterity or strength in their hands to operate these secondary controls. So the next category is congenital or developmental issues. And so although many of these can be categorized as neurological, I place them in this category because they're not necessarily acquired. These are something that, again, are usually congenital. Sometimes this population, some of the things we're looking for, some of these people are certainly drivers, but sometimes they maybe transport only. And so we're looking at devices to help the family actually get the person in and out. They may have difficulty with transfers because of their limited functional mobility. And these are some examples of seat adaptations. The one on the left is called the XL seat. And what you do is when you open the driver, and this is for a driver side application, but it can certainly be used in the passenger side. What the person would do is at once they open the car door, the seat folds down, the person transfers onto the XL seat and uses that little support arm for safety and balance. And that seat actually elevates up so it's level with the car seat, and the person can transfer over into the car seat. So that really helps cross that threshold of the door, either if they're transferring from a wheelchair or they just do not have the ability to kind of scoop up into such a high seat. The image on the right is called the XL base. And in one simple motion, that base rotates out, lowers down out of the vehicle, and so the person can transfer from their wheelchair into that seat and be lifted up into the car. And again, it just makes that transfer a little bit easier. For little people or those who have dwarfism, often driving can be difficult because they cannot reach the pedals. So some options we have for them is, first of all, they can use hand controls. That is one option. But sometimes we'll prescribe pedal extensions. And the image on the left is actually a client of mine, a former client, who used pedal extensions. And what we did is we gave her a customized seat cushion to give her a little seat boost. You can see on the floor of the vehicle we put what we call a false floor so that her heels and her feet can actually rest so they're not just dangling in the midair. So she actually has somewhere to plant her heel when she pivots between the gas and brake pedal. The image on the right is another example of a different type of pedal extension that is actually mounted a little differently than the one on the left. We also have things like chronic health issues that we need to address in driver rehab. Cardiovascular issues are, you know, people sometimes have unstable or poorly managed cardiac conditions that can have the potential for sudden or unpredictable loss of consciousness. We work with clients who have diabetes, and we need to be aware that uncontrolled diabetes is a contraindication for driving, as is untreated sleep apnea or narcolepsy. All of these issues are some chronic conditions that may contribute to their ability to drive. But let's look closely at diabetes, and I've kind of made a couple mentions to this today. But driving by persons who have diabetes may be impaired by really three factors: hyperglycemia, hypoglycemia, and then the complications. And I really want to hone in on the hypoglycemia, because certain patients who are greater risk for hypoglycemia are not always aware of that, and they really need to be counseled on how to detect that and how to monitor that and avoid that when their blood sugars drop, because they should not be driving with low blood sugar. The complications that we often see are related to cognitive impairment, visual disturbances, as well as peripheral neuropathy. And that peripheral neuropathy can cause a loss of sensation in the lower extremities. And again, this is something that occurs progressively. So it's not a sudden onset where they realize all of a sudden, oh gosh, I don't feel my feet anymore. It comes on very slowly and progressively. And when we're doing a clinical assessment, they'll finally admit they can't feel the bottom of their feet. And clearly, that is a contraindication for driving. And they're very often in denial because, you know, let's face it, we all know the gas pedal's on the right, the brake pedal's on the left. And we've done it for 30, 40 years. We know where our foot is. But what can happen is these clients who have peripheral neuropathy, their feet start slipping off the pedals, and, you know, they dismiss that, or they're hitting the brake pedal too hard, or in worst-case scenario, they start to hit the brake pedal, and they miss, and they hit the gas pedal and the car surges forward and they have an accident. And only then do they decide they probably shouldn't be driving or they need to come and be evaluated for hand controls, which again, another population that could benefit from mechanical hand controls. So, sometimes clients who, or these are some examples of persons who maybe are able to ambulate for short distances, yet may need a way to transport their mobility devices. So the example on the left is the Chariot, and it's a nice little slick device. It can be installed on a sedan with a Class 1 or Class 2 hitch, and that platform comes down to the ground. They can ride up their wheelchair or scooter on there. It secures on there, and the person can walk up to their driver's seat and take off and drive. Likewise, the image on the right is another way of securing your mobility device in your vehicle. This device actually has a boom arm that swings out, a cable deploys, attaches to the scooter or the manual wheelchair or power wheelchair, and they're able then to lift that up. It goes into the back hatch of the vehicle. The person does need to be able to stand, have the balance to do this maneuvering, as well as to walk around to the front of the vehicle. But again, some options for people who can at least walk short distances and store their mobility device. Another example or option for lifting or transporting a manual wheelchair is this, and this is called the Speedy Lift. And it's a nice, small, believe it or not, it is a relatively small, compact device. What the person does is transfers from their wheelchair into their seat, backs the wheelchair up into the Speedy Lift. It attaches onto that lift. It's fast moving, and with one click, it takes about 30 seconds, and the design takes up very little space, and in most cases, only one seat is taken up inside the vehicle. So that's really ideal for in minivans where maybe a family wants to keep the use of multiple seats. So that was many of the typical types of clinical diagnosis seen in driver rehab, and there are many, many more, but I definitely wanted to give you a kind of a brief overview of some of the clinical diagnoses, the implications for driving, and you had an opportunity to see some of the vehicles and adaptive equipment options clients have based on their functional skills and abilities. So, a frequent question or comment that I get is, this is great and this is wonderful, but who pays for this? And it really depends on where you're practicing, where the driver rehab program is located. Medicare may or may not cover portions of driver rehab, depending on the area and the location, the fiscal intermediary, how they interpret the Medicare regulations. They may approve the occupational therapy evaluation or not. And so that's something that needs to be investigated wherever you practice. The Office of Vocational Rehab is a great funding source for driver rehabilitation because driving is so important for a person's ability to resume gainful employment or to get to school or to work. So OVR frequently assists with driving evaluation, driving training, as well as equipment and vehicle modifications. Workers' compensation, when the person qualifies, frequently will cover driver rehab. In addition to those, sometimes charitable organizations will give a certain amount of funding for different evaluation or equipment. For example, the National MS Society or the MS Foundation funds anywhere between $200 and $500 or more, depending on the situation. Other than those, you really kind of have to look around and search for other funding. There's sometimes other third-party sources, sometimes private businesses, and sometimes families do fundraisers and different ways of fundraising for the equipment that a person may need. So I would be remiss without acknowledging that technology is ever-changing, and it certainly is impacting driving and our ability to drive. There are such advances in intelligent transportation systems where our transportation infrastructure, there's communication between vehicles and traffic lights, and information that's being provided to our vehicles about traffic jams or accidents that are occurring. And so that transmission of data between vehicle and our infrastructure is occurring now, and that continues to change and evolve. And the jury's still out on how that's going to impact our drivers who possibly have medical impairments. We have multiple advanced driving systems as well. 5 years ago, features that were just thought of and talked about are now becoming standard equipment in vehicles. Forward sensors, lane departure warning systems, blind zone assist. So some of these features, again, where we were talking about wouldn't that be a great thing to have, are now standard in our vehicles. So again, to any type of technology that helps our clients to become independent in their transportation options is really great. It really helps people become more independent and hopefully improve their quality of life. So that, I believe, is all I have. So thank you very much. And here's my contact information if you need it.